call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a public hearing today on two bills, and I will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 28. Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 28 comes to you from the Interim Committee, Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. And what it does is it looks at ORS 316.003, which has a general tax policy statement for the legislature to serve as a guide. And what the bill does is changes that language. It updates some of the language around tax equity. It adds some goals concerning adequacy, economic growth, or stability in tax administration, some traditional goals in there. And then it also puts in an emphasis on the importance of monitoring and evaluating tax expenditures, which is not in the statute now. Kind of a history of this bill, it goes back to 1993. And I was not working with the legislature at that time, but I did observe this committee discussion quite a bit. Senate Revenue Committee under Chair Shirley Gold had long discussions about this, the bill that became the statute. And the chair at the time, her goal was to put in some general guiding principles that should be followed when the legislature is considering tax policy. So what Senate Bill 28 attempts to do is update some of that language and also build in some of the discussions that the revenue committees and task forces have had a lot through interim task forces, such as the Revenue Restructuring Task Force that was just completed its work last month. So that's kind of the genesis of it, and it's really intended to be just kind of more the interpretation we've had from the discussions the committees have had. So designed to serve as a means for you to discuss, you know, what your intents are and to lay that out in statute, what you think the goals should be of the tax system.
And Paul, if I can just ask you a question before we ask for comments from the audience. You've been around for a long time. How much do you see this bill actually being considered as this revenue committee and previous revenue committees do their work?
Madam Chair, I think it does serve some purpose. I think particularly the tax expenditure statement in there would give some direction. But I think the primary use has been, at least my perception, has been in these interim task forces that are really looking at the overall design and structure of the system. And this has been, in fact, what I've typically done is when we begin these processes is to make a copy of the statute and say, kind of, this is where we are, this is what we've got in statute as a direction. So so when you're looking at the overall system and questioning, you know, how is it doing, we've used this as kind of a starting point.
Okay, thank you. I don't see a sign-up sheet. Do we have folks? No sign up. We have testimony here in front of us from John Mullen, but I don't see John Mullen in the.
He had to go to another committee.
He had to go to another committee. Okay, well, let the record show that we have received testimony from John Mullen, who's co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and we will put that in the record from this meeting. Okay, so anybody else want to speak about this? Deborah, did you want to have any comments about this bill? Okay. We just can't drag anybody up here, huh? Okay. Thank you very much. And does any committee member have questions of Paul or Deborah's in the audience? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just looking at it, it raises some questions about what the language means.
Okay. Do you want us to drag Deborah up here?
Some of this stuff, certainly welcome, is kind of philosophical, I guess, maybe, mm-hmm. because these are really policy issues. Mm-hmm. But I would just wonder what equitably divided between households and businesses, what does that mean?
Madam Chair, that is an issue that we could talk a good deal about. It's in there, I think, primarily because we hear it a lot, and we hear that sense when we've had public testimony and we've had looked at various restructuring plans. There's been an interest in that business household split. Now, the next issue becomes, and to me the bigger issue would be, how would you actually interpret this to apply to, for example, a revenue restructuring plan? What does equity mean? And and I think a lot of economists would argue, a lot of public finance economists, would use probably a different measure of equity at the business side than you would at the household side. It would tend to be more of a benefit type analysis, whereas the household tends to be more of an ability to pay. So it would be a question of meshing those approaches. And but the reason for including it there is basically because we hear it a lot. And it seems to be an issue with the public when they evaluate the system, whether it's fair or not. This is something that consistently comes up.
Oh, and to follow up on your comment, Senator Morris, I'm just wondering if we could have another category here for equitable and fair between businesses, because we have many different kinds of businesses in Oregon and within the business community. You know, I think there has to be a sense of fairness there as well. Is that comport with that you're our business spokesperson on the committee?
No. Are you listening responses on through?
Yeah.
Okay. If I may, and then I'll stop.
That's what this is for. It's a public hearing. Once in a while, we actually get to talk if no one else is here.
Line 16, the deletion of shielding genuine subsistence income from taxation. That's a major problem, mm-hmm. in my judgment, in our current tax system. We are taxing people at income brackets that in today's economy are right at the subsistence level. And it's a disproportionate share. And as a matter of policy, I don't think that's a good policy. What we have today is good policy. So I would, I don't know just how maybe we'd address that, Paul. But
Paul, why was that taken out? That's a good question.
If you look at a lot of the language there, it's kind of pieces of equity, pieces of, I guess I interpret a lot of it as pieces of ability to pay. And so you have the based on ability to pay, which is the large B there, which is in here, but it would include those kinds of interpretations. I think, for example, the line that Senator Morris has pointed to would be part of the ability to pay. I mean, it's just a big component of it.
Yeah, it would, but I'm just wondering if we might consider making a specific on that particular point, because it, you know, ability to pay when you get into the higher income brackets is a very different issue than when it is when you have only subsistence. And right now we do tax people at subsistence level. We've improved it a little bit with the earned income tax credit, but I think it might be good to add that specific back in. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Senator Morris?
Yeah, if we were in a different environment economically, it might be an appropriate thing to revisit those mm-hmm. tax brackets. Mm-hmm. But of course, in this environment, it would be very difficult to do that. But I think clearly we have a deficiency in our system.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, would you be thinking perhaps about having some categories underneath capital B, section 1.
Correct. In other words,
we based on ability to pay, then we would have perhaps some statements under there that would clarify what you mean by ability to pay.
Right, because the original statute had that kind of, it mentioned ability to pay, and then it had a subcategory, the mm-hmm. aggressive, the shielding, equalization of tax burden. I think maybe that was actually a good way to do it. This does shorten it, which is always a good thing, but yeah, I think that would be good.
Madam Chair.
Senator Haas.
Wait. Where are these goals used, and where what's the relevance? Because clearly we're not meeting them right now. If you look at, for example, fairness, or if you look at the Measure 50 issue, for example, we're not meeting some of these goals, even distribution. So how does this manifest itself and to try and get closer to those goals?
Before you came in, Paul said that the main use of this has been in interim discussions of tax reform. Did you want to add anything, Paul?
Yes, that's correct, Senator Haas. The main use I've had of this is when we start one of these task forces or joint interim committees, we've had a number of them, I make a copy of the statute and say this is kind of where we start from. Now, so it becomes a beginning point. I think ideally, I think the goal of Senator Gold and the committee in 93 was to have these principles in front of the committees as they look at major tax proposals. And, of course, I think as you look at those, some of them are not going to fit all of these. Mm-hmm. And so then you get to raise the question of where are the trade-offs, and but it gives you a system for a framework for trying to look at those proposals. But as I say, I think the biggest use for them has been to look at these major reform proposals.
Go ahead, Sam.
Well, just follow up far below that in sort of the priority here is, and you'll appreciate this being a former journalist yourself, is I would change the wording of some of these and not begin the questions with B. I like the way it was laid out in the first format. And just sort of maybe more of a listing instead of be viewed as fair, be based on ability.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. I see.
That's the difference between a broadcast journalist and a print journalist. I think B is just fine in this case.
There should be a verb here somewhere in there, unless you've got an amendment that says B is a verb.
No. Taxation must. You put that at the front of every... See, that's
fragment.
The difference between a print journalist and a broadcast journalist. We are grammatically superior.
We were better paid.
Correct. You got me on that one. Paul, another thing that comes to mind as we discuss is, some of the tax proposals we've looked at in the past, like Senator Morris's of last session, really had one of the positive things about them was that they spread out the tax burden to people who currently are escaping taxation for one reason or another. And this is not just a stalking horse for a consumption tax, but the principle itself is something that I'm wondering if we could get that principle in here to be as inclusive. Maybe that would be the right word. Tax policy should be as inclusive as possible so that everyone's paying their fair share and not just the people who own property or the people who make income. And maybe that will be seen as a stalking horse, but I think the principle is still good. Unless you object, of course, Senator Morris.
No. I'd write language in here that says a sales tax is the best policy. Can we do that, Paul?
Well, we could
put that
do
small
that.
Print.
we could do that, Senator Morris. We can do anything we want in this committee if we can get the votes.
All right. Any other comments, Senator Tucker?
Diane's, I think, ahead of me.
Oh, Diane. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess personally, I don't, although we could probably spend the rest of our time together debating these principles, I don't think it's particularly productive because, as others have pointed out, we may not be meeting these goals anyway. And also, there's so much subjectivity in concepts like equity. You know, it's like, you know, equity is whatever your own personal values say is fair. So to have language that says, you know, a system that is viewed as fair by the citizens of Oregon, I think is, I mean, that's almost like not useful, because I don't know how you would ever evaluate that. I don't know. I don't think, I mean, you're always going to find a significant proportion of citizens who think we have an unfair tax system, and so we would never meet that one.
Well, you know, I had that same comment to Paul when I first, that was one that kind of jumped out at me, and he had actually a pretty good response. Do you want to hear that before you go on, or do you want to finish?
No, I just want to rant and rave.
I didn't want to lose the thought, so I knew I'd forget.
No, I'd love to hear it from Dr. Warner.
Well, you know, I guess the way that I had thought of this is, in the context of some of the decisions you'll be making with tax compliance bills, is it's very important that the system be recognized or viewed as fair by those who are paying the taxes. Because ultimately, you have, in the income tax especially, you have a volunteer system, volunteer reporting. And if people feel that the system is not fair, then Deborah's job at Department of Revenue is going to be much more difficult and much more expensive. So there has to be some general consensus that this is a reasonable way to tax. There's some fairness within that system. Now, maybe not, you know, this is as ideal as it could be, but once you start to lose that, and we've seen this in some countries that don't rely on the income tax, for example, as much, use more consumption taxes because some of that general sense is broken down. And compliance becomes very difficult once you reach that stage. I guess the other issue I would say in terms of the equity is that the view of equity does change over time. And we've seen it historically in different countries and in the U.S. And I think you can look at different taxes in regarding their flexibility. And there is a comment in here on flexibility, and that's one of the ways I think to evaluate a system. Can it respond as those views of equity change? And frankly, one of the strengths of the income tax is its flexibility. I mean, you can set rates and exempt types of incomes or types of expenditures with a great deal more flexibility than you can most other revenue sources. So those are the kinds of thoughts there.
I guess I do appreciate the work that went into this. It just seems like, in grappling with actual proposals, that's where really these values come to play, and it's not that necessarily that helpful to have just broad principles. It's really how you implement them that I think is the proof of the pudding.
Yeah, I guess I would disagree. I think it's good when you're starting any conversation, like, you know, certainly when we were starting the revenue task force, to have principles laid out in front of you that you have as kind of a sideboard, so that you, just to remind you, if nothing else, because if you go for one of these values and don't consider the others, you could end up in a different place. So I think this is a worthy exercise for our committee, and it gives us also a chance. I mean, we're in very tough times. It does give us a chance to step back a little bit and try to, you know, determine for the future what the sideboards are going to be. And we're probably in the most difficult time right now that any of us have experienced and hopefully will experience. I mean, I think this is already tougher than 2002, 2003. So I'll stand up for it.
Madam Chair,
Telfer.
Thank you. Well, I was going to follow Diane's thought process in that, you know, when you start adding definition, and I'm going to give you an example. Adequacy. The revenue system must provide sufficient revenue to meet the needs of the citizen. Well, who determines the needs? If that's ways and means, then we're going to recognize a huge increase in taxes in order to cover those needs. And so it's almost like instead of saying must, it should say taxation must consider instead of be. Meaning you need to consider these things, but who's to determine what's adequacy, what's equity? It's kind of like whoever's in charge of considering at the time is the one who defines those. But you know, I hate to see it when we try to put definition to concepts.
Because it's always, at the end of the day, it's always a balancing, and somebody's needs or somebody else's wants. Senator Hess.
Well, I think, you know, you it says the goals that recognize, you know, whatever we decide. I don't think you're saying it shall be, you know, equitable based on this. I mean, these are just principles. Mm-hmm. I think when there are principles, it gives you some guidance.
Okay. Any other comments? Gil, did you want to say anything? Okay.
All right. Chair.
Senator Morris.
If I may. Line 31, the sentence just struck me as not reading maybe the way it could read. I would suggest the revenue system must support economic growth in the state and not act as a deterrent. If you throw in raise sufficient mm-hmm. revenue, I don't know what that means.
Actually, yeah, because the idea of sufficiency is right above it. I would like that change. Paul, why is it? You want to push back on that? If we just said the revenue system
delete raise mm-hmm. sufficient revenue yeah. to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the thinking there is the first discussion of adequacy is, it, you know, could fit in that, but the idea was that the revenue system must raise sufficient revenue to support the business climate, the infrastructure, the services that are directly used by business to be competitive.
Oh, okay.
That was the distinguishing feature. You could draw that from the previous sub B there as well.
Well, you could accomplish that if you change two to that.
Okay.
Raise sufficient. It might read a little differently.
So how would that read then?
That supports.
Must.
Sufficient revenue for basic services to support.
Oh, okay.
Economic growth and not act as a deterrent to growth.
Okay, the revenue system must raise sufficient revenue for basic services, you said?
It supports economic growth in the state and not act as a deterrent.
Right.
But it's the basic services that makes the economy
right.
function.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have schools, people don't want to come here.
Right.
And I did have one other thing, Madam Chair.
Before you get to that one, would you think it would be positive if we've kind of changed the tone of that one for, we're now talking about raising sufficient revenue for basic services that support economic development. Do you think then we would need another one that said the tax structure itself, the revenue should be raised in a way that supports economic development? In other words, you're not taxing people out of business and you're not letting the rich guys off scot-free type of thing.
Well, the revenue system, if it's a deterrent to economic investment, the alternative to that would be that it should support economic investment.
Should support, but the structure itself, regardless of how much revenue you raise, and regardless of how well you're funding basic services, there's also the structure itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a positive thing to put in there. Do you agree, Paul?
Chair, are you thinking about pulling out this deterrent to growth and making that a separate point?
Yeah, actually, the deterrent to growth could be in that second.
Mm-hmm.
So you're supporting economic growth in the state with funding basic services, and then you're not acting as a deterrent to growth by how you structure the system.
So So something of the tax structure should not act as a deterrent to economic growth.
Right. Does that?
And then the previous would be the revenue system must raise sufficient revenue that supports economic growth in the state.
Right.
Just period.
Sufficient revenue that. Okay, so you want to take the idea of basic services. You don't want to mention that.
We have the basic services above. We have sufficient revenue to meet the needs of its citizens.
That's very sufficient revenue that supports. Yeah. That meet your criteria, Frank?
Mm-hmm, that'd
okay.
be good.
And then what's your next one?
Well, this is a hard one. I think it gets back to the issue that Paul raises. If you have a system that actually functions in a way that the underground economy flourishes, that's not good policy, and it creates a, you know, the tax gap just grows. And I don't know how you would address that, but the dependence that we have on income tax likely promotes a more robust, if I might use that word, underground economy than a consumption tax. But that's definitely a negative issue in terms of the equity, the fairness.
I want to try to get at that. I want to try to get at that principle somehow of letting, you know, having segments of, you know, of the economic terrain untaxed versus, and also the concept of actually encouraging an underground economy. I want to try to, let's give that some thought. We're not going to move this bill today, and we're going to have some amendments, so let's give that some thought and work with Paul on that.
Okay. Madam Chair, as we move into that, and I'm sorry, my fire department is here today. So.
Do you need to run?
Yeah.
Why are you sorry?
No, they came. That's why they pulled me out of the meeting
for
5 minutes. So
I'm glad there's not a fire.
Well, I'm glad there's not one in bed right now. what is the driver behind or the impetus to call this bill into being, particularly with the definitions? I mean, why did we feel compelled to put definitions to some of the,
you know, I think
goals?
It actually started with trying to get some to insert into our tax policy framework some references to some you know, notice of tax expenditures in an organized way. You know, we give tax credits for this, deductions for that. And we don't have, you know, in this tax policy, we don't have, you know, we don't have the concept of, hey, we've got to look at those things regularly to see what they're doing. I think that's the way it started. And then once we started, this hasn't been updated since 1993, and we've been through a lot of things since then. So, Paul, add to that.
Well, Madam Chair, that's right. The tax expenditure statute, and we'll be going through that report here next week, but the tax expenditure report was actually established in 95, so the biennium, or the session after this language was put in, so it was not an issue at that time, and so that was one of the other purposes, is to put in this section 1 sub 2 there that gives some direction on the tax expenditure report and gives a clear need to have a policy statement, which is required by that statute.
Well, and thank you then. So excluding, that's a good explanation for two, but I'm looking at defining equity, defining adequacy. What was the, I mean, we've attempted to define them as a goal. And I feel very uncomfortable when you try to start defining something that is conceptual, and the value is in the discussion when you're wrestling with these things versus trying to give it a definition. Because, like I say, I'm really concerned with the revenue system that must provide sufficient revenue to meet the needs of the citizens. well, that's like having a teenager that says, well, I have to have this new car. That's my need. And, and you happen to have a parent that says, well, okay, that's your need today.
Actually, Senator Telfer, that is in the, that's very similar to the language we have in the Constitution.
What is?
That provision, the revenue system must provide sufficient revenue. The Constitution says, in effect, if there's not enough revenue to support the government, then the legislature shall raise taxes to...
Maybe we ought to start with the Constitution that needs to be changed, because I don't think that's what we're doing this session. And but if that's what the Constitution says we have to do...
Yeah. So.
That was Senator Gordley's reminder, constant reminder to us.
Yes. None of us knew about it until Senator Gordley dug it up one day. And
we continue to ignore it, or
once in a while there's a lawsuit around it. There was one recently on schools, but anyway, it's. I think what the way I see this is a way to really just flag issues that, as you're talking about taxation, which is a very complex and far-reaching a policy that hits everyone directly, or should, that we make sure that all the things that should be considered, including adequacy, are on the table. I mean, it would be great to have a 1% income tax. Everyone would just love it. But it would hardly meet the adequacy guideline. You know, not to say that we're going to, you know, I don't think when you put something like adequacy in it, it does not mean that when Ways and Means comes to you and says we need another $2 billion, which they easily could, that it's obligatory for us, because you know we're a system of votes, and everything you do is, you know, people have to vote, and so it's our process.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something, Madam Chair? I guess my suggestion on the way to think about this and the principles is that I think that the Revenue Restructuring Task Force is a classic example. When, you know, this was a citizen and legislative group, they come in, the bill spells out things they want to do, but they're really questioning, well, what kind of guidance should we use, what kind of criteria should we use to look at all these proposals? And we had, you know, proposals of every kind of tax change imaginable. And so I would see this, and if I were assigned the staff of doing this again, you know, to have something that reflects the thinking of the legislature. Say these are the things that the legislature thinks is important to serve as a guide when you're considering the tax system, whether it's doing what it's supposed to do, and how would we evaluate proposed changes. How would we know if we're achieving more what the legislature thinks we should be? So that's kind of the way I would see it in that particular context.
And, you know, additions like the economic, the reference to economic growth, economic development, you know, that's new, and that's something that we're very aware of now in this environment, is that we really got to have that as a principle anytime we talk about tax policy. I mean, we just had a debate in this committee last Friday on that point,
adequacy.
And
well, just one final comment, and then I'll drop this. But and I agree 100%. And it is listed as adequacy. It's when we start to define it,
right,
is where I think that's where the problem comes for me. Is when we actually below in the bold in the new verbiage try to define it. But it is mentioned. Adequacy, flexibility, they're all mentioned here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in trying to define it.
Well, but we're not really defining it here.
Adequacy. The revenue system.
Must provide sufficient revenue to meet the needs of the citizens.
That's it's much more definitive, I guess, than listing it above as thing to consider adequacy. And then I believe the positive that occurs there is in the conversation of what is adequacy,
mm-hmm,
versus coming down here to say that it's where you've got enough revenue to cover the needs of the citizens. Again, define needs. What's the need level?
The legislature does that. The needs of the citizens as defined by the legislature. So that will be the legislative record on this subject.
And, Madam Chair, just one more
That's
comment.
That's really what happens. In
Maybe after what I said, I'm not entitled to make any more comments. But
yes, you certainly are, Senator Rosenbaum.
So, I mean, I do think that there's good intention here, and this could be useful, though I think I still think it's limited in its usefulness. But I do think I agree with including re-including the subsistence language or some version of that, because particularly right now I think it would to repeal that language and then have vaguer language would not send a good message. And then the one other thing I was looking at, and I actually saw this in John Mullen's comments, are that he commented that we're doing away with language at lines 22 and 23 that say that in furthering these goals, we have to consider the system as a whole and how the parts interact. And I do think that's a really good principle to retain because, you know, at the end, you really want some holistic look at this. It doesn't just, that looks at it as a whole, not just as the sum of its parts.
Well, good. We have a good discussion and Mr. Mullen's comments, and I think we can come back maybe with some tweaks and revisions on this bill to look at again. Is there any other comments? Any reflections from you, Deborah?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. We do appreciate inclusion of efficient administration in this. It's not in the current law, and that is something that we do try to point out when you're considering tax changes, the impact on our agency and on taxpayers in trying to comply with those changes. So we do appreciate that being called out specifically.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill. And open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 40. I am so bad on bill numbers. Welcome, Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40 also comes to you from the Interim Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And it modifies how the surplus revenue refunds are calculated by having that refund calculated after allowance of the credit for taxes imposed by another state. If you'll recall, prior to 2007, the way the surplus refunds or credits were calculated was based on the after-credit tax liability of the taxpayer. There, you had the percentage, and it was applied to that after-credit liability. In 2007, Senate Bill 819 changed that to the before-credit liability. And the reason that came up as an issue, it was in response to concern that kicker refunds and credits could reduce the efficacy of certain tax credits as policy tools. And the one that came to the forefront was the Betsy credit. Essentially, if there were a large kicker, and in 2007 there was the billion-dollar kicker, so we were talking about a 20-21% refund, then that essentially could reduce a taxpayer's liability down to zero or lower, and then that reduces the value of other credits that a taxpayer would claim because their liability would be reduced. So the solution was to take that percentage and apply it to the pre-credit number. There is no revenue impact. The amount of the kicker wasn't changed. It was just distributed a little bit differently across taxpayers. So to the extent that a taxpayer's pre-credit tax and post-credit tax were different, the amount of kicker they would get. But it did not change the overall kicker. On the back of the SMS is just a table out of a publication from the Department of Revenue that shows the impact of the credit for taxes paid to other states by AGI level. And so for 2006, which is the most recent year for which we have tax returns, there were 13,318 full-year filers claimed just about $37 million in this credit. And then there were another 8,000 or 9,000 per-year non-resident taxpayers who claimed the credit as well.
And basically, when the whole discussion last session, the idea of taxes paid to other state wasn't even mentioned. I mean, this was kind of an unintended consequence here.
Well, I believe that the discussion was just none of the individual credits were separated out. The only discussion that they kind of brought the issue to the forefront was the Betsy credit.
Well, and the cultural trust credit, I believe, was also mentioned. Yeah. So this bill, the effect of the bill would be to what?
Rather than having the percentage applied to the before credit liability, it would be applied to. Actually not a line on the return. It's that before credit liability reduced by this amount of credit, and then the percentage would be applied to that number. So you'd have the gross tax less the credits paid for taxes to paid for taxes paid to another state. That amount would be the basis for determining an individual's kicker amount.
Right. So this would only single out the credits for taxes paid to other states. But the other credits, the Betsy credit, the cultural trust, and similar credits, would get the more favorable treatment.
Correct. They would be
for the taxpayer. Does everybody understand this? It took a while for me to get my head around this. Senator Haas.
Can you do a hypothetical tax case?
Return.
Sure.
So we have a kicker percentage of 20%. And let's say a taxpayer's gross tax before credits are taken is, this is always challenging math, quick math in my head, $2,000. And they have a credit for taxes paid to another state of $100. So current law, you would take 20%. Their kicker would be 20% times the $2,000. Pre-credit liability. So their kicker refund would be $400. If this were to become law, that 20% would be applied to the $2,000 minus $100 or $1,900. So then their kicker refund would be $3,800.
So what this amounts to is we've been giving kickers as a percentage of taxes that people pay to other states. And the intent of the kicker is to give a percentage of taxes that we pay to Oregon. Yes, is that correct? Mm-hmm.
And the way that percentage
except
is counted.
Pardon? Except for the other
credits. Except for the other credits, right.
And the way that percentage is calculated is after, at the end of the biennium, the amount by which actual revenues exceeded the forecast. That's the amount to go back, and that is not changed. That number is divided by, under current law, the total of gross tax, and that's what sets the percentage. And so the way the percentage would be calculated now, it would be rather than taking the amount of the surplus divided by that gross tax, it would be divided by gross tax less the taxes paid to other states. So in that way, the total amount of the kicker is not changed. But there will be incremental changes to those people who claim, to the 20,000 or so taxpayers who claim this credit.
So the people who do the Betsy credit or do the cultural trust credit, just to name two, would still have their advantage of how their kickers, they wouldn't pay any penalty for having taken the credit in terms of their kicker, but the people from out of state would not get a kicker percentage for the taxes that they paid to other states. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's kind of like there are credits that are incentives for certain behavior, Betsy, et cetera. When you pay a tax to another state, it's because the income usually came from that other state, and it doesn't go towards the kicker, doesn't go towards the excess that's built up in the state of Oregon's coffers,
correct.
So they shouldn't be getting any of it back.
Correct.
There are some, there could also be some Oregonians that are paying a tax to another state because of lack of reciprocity in the way the tax credits are handled. California at one point was like that until about 10 or 15 years ago. But in any case, most credits are an incentive or helping for human service social reasons, the state credit is. So I would say it was an unintended consequence when this came about in its first enactment.
It was indeed. Senator Rosenbaum?
No, I have no comment.
Okay. All right, any other comments? Anybody want to add anything to this? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40. Any other business before the committee?
We could have had a work session on this.
I know. Why didn't we have a work session? Okay, we are adjourned.